This is a somewhat odd and uncharacteristic talk tonight. The occasion of this talk is that this week in the Christian liturgy is Holy Week. So yesterday was Palm Sunday, this Thursday is Holy Thursday, Friday is Good Friday, and then this coming Sunday is Easter Sunday. And this year I was just thinking about the events of the Christian story and how they might look from a Buddhist perspective. And so I'll begin by sharing sort of the basic outline of the Christian story. I'm sure most of you are reasonably familiar with it. A few things I'll say before I do that. First of all, I'll say that I believe all religions are true. And so I believe fully in the Christian story, as I believe in Buddhism and Islam and all the rest. But I want to make very clear that in talking about this, I'm not asking anyone else for belief. And I think I would even say that the whole question of belief is somewhat beside the point. Because when we're in that place of, do I believe or not? Is the story correct or not? Is it right or wrong or not? We're stuck in these rigid dichotomies. And the sacred is always beyond those dichotomies. You know, you think of Rumi's famous, you know, there's beyond all ideas of right and wrong, there's a field, let's meet there, you know, that kind of thing. So the basic outline of the Christian story, after a few years of ministry, Jesus and his disciples went to Jerusalem, and they went to Jerusalem for Passover, as many Jewish people, both past and present, have done. The Holy Thursday is the day of the Last Supper, and the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. So he was celebrating Passover with his disciples. And during this meal, he blessed bread and wine. And this is understood by Christians as instituting the sacrament of the Eucharist. And so this is the kind of the centerpiece of many Christian liturgies, the bread and the wine part. The four Gospels have slightly different accounts of these. Some of them give these long discourses during the Last Supper. After the supper, he went to a place called the Garden of Gethsemane. He was in agony because he knew what was coming. Toward dawn, he was arrested by the Romans. And I'll back up and I'll say the people who really had it in for Jesus were the Jewish religious authorities, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. They saw him as a blasphemer, but they didn't have the legal right to kill anybody. And only the Romans had that right. And so they had to essentially portray him to the Romans as a kind of revolutionary, you know, as a political threat of some kind. And so Jesus was arrested, handed over to the Romans. He was interrogated. Then they tortured him. And then, as was standard, he carried the wood for his cross to the place of the crucifixion. That was the, sort of the standard procedure for the Romans. And crucifixion, just a gruesome way to die, was one of the standard ways that Romans killed people. They would kill non-Roman citizens that way. If you were a Roman citizen, you had the right that even if you had to be put to death, you wouldn't be crucified. They'd behead you or something quick like that. So according to the Christian story, around noon, he was nailed to the cross. So this was on Good Friday. He was on the cross 3 hours. And incidentally, 3 hours is a relatively short, in fact, it's a remarkably short time for a crucifixion. Sometimes the crucified victims would last for days. We know this historically. And what was tricky about this was that this was on Friday. And of course, Friday evening was the beginning of the Sabbath. And this was a very special Sabbath because it was the middle of Passover. And so the Jewish people were concerned. They didn't want the crucifixions lasting beyond sundown, because then, you know, if someone died, say, in the middle of the night, then they'd have to just stay there all of Saturday, because you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath. They wouldn't be able to tend to the body essentially until Sunday morning. And so there was some concern. And apparently we're told that the other people crucified with Jesus, they actually broke their legs to try and accelerate the process. But for whatever reason, Jesus died after 3 hours. And then they sort of hastily, you know, found a tomb, stuck him in there. They had to get all that done before sunset. Then the story continues that, you know, Saturday, of course, is the day of rest. You can't do any work. And so Sunday, the women wanted to sort of finish the process. There was a ritual anointing of the body and, you know, adding spices and myrrh and this sort of thing. And so they were bringing all these things to the tomb. The story is that they got to the tomb and the giant stone, which had been in front of this cave, had been rolled back. And then they were concerned. They got some of the disciples. One of the disciples went in. They saw the clothes that, you know, the cloths that Jesus had been wrapped in had just been like balled up on the floor. And then they started having experiences of encounters with the resurrected Jesus. And it the resurrection stories are interesting in that they're not, it's not as if he was a tangible person walking around from point A to point B and being followed. He would just be appearing in places, sometimes appearing, and they wouldn't originally, the disciples who knew him wouldn't even recognize him. And then only after a certain amount of time, suddenly they would recognize him. And so, of course, the resurrection happened on Easter Sunday. So Holy Thursday, day of the Last Supper, Good Friday, the day of the death on the cross, Easter Sunday, the day of the resurrection. And these are, in many ways, the central events of the entire Christian narrative. Now, one question we can ask is of this narrative, and it's something that was explored by Christian theologians. Jesus was God and he was also man. Why did he have to die this gruesome way? And the very traditional sort of classical Christian answer, which grew very much out of the ancient Jewish tradition, which was a tradition based on sacrifice, it's an interpretation I would call more the, like an economic interpretation of the crucifixion, in the sense that humans sinned against God. That was an infinite penalty. Human beings being finite couldn't pay the infinite penalty. And therefore, the God-man had to die to pay the infinite price that we couldn't pay, you know. And in fact, the word redemption is etymologically goes back to economic roots, you know. To redeem is literally to buy back. And so that's a more economic interpretation. Personally, I don't think that anything economic is a particularly accurate model of how the sacred works. In the High Middle Ages, another interpretation that developed, and it was really the theologian Peter Abelard who was the advocate of this, is that Jesus dying on the cross was a way for God to have this intimate experience of human suffering. And so that he could, as it were, really be with us fully in our suffering, because he had gone through, you know, he had experienced emotional pain, he had experienced physical pain. And so it was a really being at one with humans in their suffering. And even apart from the Christian story, just to think about that idea about the sacred as having an intimate understanding of what it is to be a suffering human. you know, not so much as a head idea, but really in the place where we are emotionally intimate with the sacred. You know, how does it feel to conceive of the sacred as something that fully gets what it is for you to suffer, what your suffering feels like? I was thinking this week about the difference between compassion and empathy. Grant had posed this question last week. And I don't know that I have a fully satisfactory answer, but it feels to me that one difference is that in empathy, I have something of the taste of the other person's suffering. In some way I've been there myself, you know. Like if, you know, someone were, say, withdrawing from heroin, you know, and suffering that way, I would have tremendous compassion for them, but I really don't know what that experience is about, you know. I have experienced a lot of grief in my life, as many other people have had. And so if someone else is in grief, even though I might not be in the full experience of grief in that moment, there's part of me deep in my body that registers this kind of, you know, I've been there. I know what that's like, you know, even though I don't know exactly what anyone else's experience is. There's this sense of kinship in empathy that I think is something that's not always present in compassion. And so we might even say that one difference in accent between Jesus and the Buddha is that the Buddha certainly offers compassion, but Jesus offers empathy. You know. I will say at a certain level of abstraction, you might say an archetypal reading of the story, the Jesus dying and rising in many ways is equivalent to the Buddha achieving enlightenment. It is the death of the old person and the breakthrough to a new, you know, transnormal kind of life. And the interesting thing about the accent of the Christian story is that the suffering part of that is more real. You know, there's this way that the Buddhist story almost spins it like, you know, the Buddha is presented in such heroic terms. You know, he sat at the bow tree and made the great vow, you know, I will not rise until I achieve enlightenment. And then he, you know, temptations came, but of course he resisted them. And, you know, he heroically just plowed through to the end. And we don't really get the sense of all the suffering, all the human suffering that is involved in that process, you know, whereas that's more front and center in the Christian story. You know, ultimately the enlightenment is about a death of the ego, and ego experiences that as a real death, you know, like that's, there's nothing light or pleasant about that, you know. And the resurrection, one way to think about this is the Greeks had two words for life. The word bios and the word zoe. Bios was an individual life, my life, your life, you know, the life of a particular person, a particular animal, something that begins and ends. Zoe is archetypal life, capital L life, the life that just flows through spring and you know, bursts through the world season after season, you know, the radiance of children, the playfulness of adolescence, you know, we all go through the stage where at one point we're children, at one point we're adolescents, and then we're looking back on those stages, but there are always children who have that same radiance, even though the individuals are changing, you know, that's capital L life. And to some extent, both the resurrection of Jesus and the enlightenment of the Buddha can be interpreted as a breakthrough from bios to zoe, from an individual ego limited perspective on life to identifying with capital L life. and that it's really a profound affirmation of life. And I would say in both Buddhism, core Buddhism, and really in the core Christian message also is a profound affirmation of life. That doesn't always come across, unfortunately, in the various ways that Christianity is packaged. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. I'm going to paste a link in the chat. And so I have a couple famous Bible quotes at the top about this. Jesus said, "Whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses it for my sake will find it." You know, a very stark statement. And again, he who finds his life, he who holds on to bios, doesn't get to the larger experience of life. But he who is really ready to lose ego, to sacrifice bios, is able to break through to the Zoe. Similarly, a little later in the Gospel of Matthew, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life would lose it, and whoever loses it for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his life?" And then in the Gospel of John, there's a long Last Supper discourse. And as part of the Last Supper discourse, Jesus says, he's saying this to the disciples, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no man than this, that a man lays down his life for his friends." And that's powerful. And just the idea that the sacred is asking us to love other people with that intensity, you know. There's something very powerful there. From William Blake, in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, he has this quote, "Eternity is in love with the productions of time. Bios, or limited life, is life that happens in time. The world of the resurrected Christ, or the enlightened experience of the Buddha, is an experience of eternity." And it's worthwhile saying, this is something I often talk about, and then in our modern secular world, we misunderstand the word eternity. We think that it just means a lot of time. Eternity is actually a different dimension. Time is the realm of being, of becoming. Eternity is the realm of being. And so that, you know, the breakthrough experience to, you know, you might say that whenever we have a timeless moment, that's a breakthrough to the experience of eternity, at least in that moment. Schopenhauer said, "Every parting gives a foretaste of death, and every coming together is a foretaste of the resurrection." So he totally symbolizes it. Balzac says, "Someday you will find out there is far more happiness in another's happiness than in your own." This interesting one from Robert William Dale. "The real truth is that while he came to preach a gospel, his chief object in coming was that there might be a gospel to preach." You know? And this whole idea that far more important than any of the words that he said was the act of sacrificing himself. Gandhi said, quite simply, "A man who was completely innocent offered himself as a sacrifice for the good of others, including his enemies, and became ransom of the world. It was a perfect act." C.S. Lewis says, "The doctrines we get out of the true myth are, of course, less true. They are translations into our concepts and ideas of that which God has already expressed in a language more adequate, namely the actual incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection." And I like the whole idea that there's an immediacy to that the verbal doctrines miss, You know, there's something very Zen in that perspective. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who lost his life in a concentration camp, said, "The cross is not a terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ." This whole idea that the cross is a beginning rather than the end. Auden said, "Christmas and Easter can be subjects for poetry, but Good Friday, like Auschwitz, cannot. The reality is so horrible that it is not surprising that people should have found it a stumbling block to faith." Mark Galley says, "But the resurrection without the crucifixion is empty optimism, an optimism that gives credence to Freud's notion that wishful thinking is the sum and substance of our faith. Include the crucifixion and our role in that bloody moment, and the whole picture changes." You know, and I would say, you know, related to that, I think there's a tendency to want to read Buddhism in terms of just the beauty of enlightenment and not the whole struggle it takes to get there. You know, I think, you know, a certain amount of the New Age movement is about packaging Buddhism that way. William Paul Young said, "The old must be torn down for the new to be raised. To have a resurrection, you must have a crucifixion. But God wastes nothing, not even the wrong we have imagined into existence. In every building torn down, there is much that remains that was once right and true and right and good, and that gets woven into the new. In fact, the new could not be what it is without the old. It is the refurbishing of the soul." From Brené Brown, "Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. It is the source of our hope, empathy, accountability, and authenticity. If we want greater clarity in our purpose or deeper meaning in our lives, vulnerability is the path." And really, the cross, among other things, is an incredibly powerful image of vulnerability at its extreme. Jody Picoult says, "Doing the right thing for somebody else occasionally means doing something that feels wrong to you." Tana French says, "Regardless of what the advertising campaigns may tell us, we can't have it all. Suffering is not an option or an anachronism. It's a fact of life. We cut off our own limbs to burn on some altar. The crucial thing is to choose the altar that's worth it and the limb you can accept losing, to go consenting to the sacrifice." Veronica Roth says, "She taught me all about real sacrifice, that it should be done from love, that it should be done from necessity, not without exhausting all other options, that it should be done for people who need your strength because they don't have enough of their own." And then finally, two from Craig Lundsberg. "The cross unerringly exposes this stunning, marvelous, and abruptly exquisite declaration that God will not let this single life of mine, with all its grotesque maladies and pathetic filth, pass into oblivion without an unflinching declaring that my life carries a value worth the expenditure of his. And if I dare look at the cross, I am utterly perplexed, but wholly enraptured by the immensity of such love as this." And he also said, "Maybe I don't have enough beginnings in my life because I fought against the endings that were about to birth those beginnings."